Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:05 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is September 30th. Well, today's an important day, not nearly really because of the presidential debate yesterday, but more because the Paycheck Protection Program expires today. So there's a lot more speculation about whether the Democrats and the Republicans can sit down together and iron out another fiscal stimulus package. So that's where the market is ebbing and flowing. There was some speculation that the two parties were still talking this morning. Then Steve Mnuchin poured some cold water on that about an hour and a half ago. The S&P 500 gave up all of its gain, and then it's recouped about half of it as we approach the close. The most important thing, however, is that it has bounced from the 3,200-point level, and it has done enough to break the sequence of lower rally highs over the course of most of September. So far, this has been a somewhat larger pullback than we've seen since March, but not meaningfully so, and support has been found in the region of the 200-day moving average. So this is rather encouraging. Then when we perhaps look at some of the other moving averages that tend to attract attention, well, the 50-day moving average now is almost exactly where the market is beginning to pause as we approach the close. So there is obviously scope for some messing around between where the 50-day and the 200-day moving average are, but as long as that 3,200-point level is held, I think we have potential for additional higher to lateral ranging at a minimum, and this still looks like a medium-term recovery scenario overall. There's still a great deal of fear in the market, but some of the indicators that are beginning to point toward renewed enthusiasm for a recovery. One thing that is quite clear is that there were pictures of people moving through airports in China today, and the places are packed. So social distancing is completely out the window there. They're no longer talking about 6 feet of distance apart, and most of the flights for Golden Week holidays are full, and everyone's wearing a mask. But in China, people were wearing masks pretty regularly anyway because of the air quality, so it doesn't represent nearly as much of a cultural shift as it does elsewhere. But the big picture, of course, is that once the fear of the spread of the coronavirus is contained, then people have gone straight back to flying. And there's still a lot of skepticism being expressed about the potential for airlines to recover. Now, one justifiable reason for thinking about that is because they were badly mismanaged companies and they had no buffer of cash on their balance sheets. And it is to be hopefully desired that they will be better managed in future. But at the same time, there's no way that governments are going to allow their airlines to go bust. So there is likely to be additional money made available to them. And they have unwound their overextension relative to the trend mean following the crushing decline in the beginning of this year. There is, I think, less potential for a lengthy Type 3 bottom for the airlines for the simple reason that they're going to have money showered upon them, and that will facilitate some form of recovery. They're also shedding workers, so their overhead is going to be contained, and they're probably going to be slow to increase that overhead in future. We also saw in here today that Disney is firing several thousand people. The share was in negative territory, but it is still holding the region of the trend mean, and there's a clear succession of ranges, one above another, and a sequence of higher reaction lows since March. And importantly, the price now is back above the $120 level, which had been an area of resistance from 2015 through to 2019. And there is the clear potential here that we're going to see additional upside. Disney obviously has got a lot of exposure to travel and tourism, so that's a a factor that's rather difficult to get over until we in fact see the lockdowns ended and people starting to move around more freely. However, I was talking today with one of the writers from a couple of well-known TV shows. He was talking about the fact that the recent Star Wars show, The Mandalorian, which has been extremely popular on the new Disney Plus the streaming service, was entirely filmed on this behind with using this huge, almost tennis court sized panel of LEDs, so that they can project any kind of background they want. So, for example, and this was the example he gave us, was when they want to film a dawn scene. Conventionally, you would have to try and get it done in one take, but it would usually take four or five takes. And that means that you have approximately 20 minutes in the morning to get your shot right. And if you don't get it right, well, then you've got to come back the day after. And obviously, that's extraordinarily expensive when you're talking about people scouting locations, transporting a whole load of equipment, and then paying for everyone to stay on location while you're trying to wait for your shot. With this new form of technology, then you can just recreate it instantly and just replay the same scene over and over until you get the shot that you want with your actors. Now, he was clear to also point out that it requires a lot of post-production work in the photo studio to get it just right. But the technology is improving so rapidly that within a couple of years, they don't anticipate that this is going to be a problem, and that they'll simply be able to do any form of filming in front of these extraordinarily large sets of LED projectors. Well, that's going to massively disrupt the movie industry. It's going to greatly compress the cost of production. It's also going to allow companies to do their production just about anywhere they want. They're no longer going to be tied to physical locations. And already the vast majority of post-production work is done remotely. And the big data files are farmed out to rendering farms. So what we're in fact seeing is that this is another industry which has historically been really very people-heavy, engaging with technological innovation. And this is, again, another example of the routes to a middle-class lifestyle for less well-educated people starting to close off. We've already seen that with manufacturing. We've seen it with coal mining and other forms of mining. With the revolution that we're seeing in renewable energies, then the roughnecking that we see, for example, in the shale and unconventional oil and gas sectors, and indeed in the conventional sectors as well, that will be more of a specialized activity. And then when you think about the fact that the movie industry employs a large number of people to do what are effectively rather menial tasks, and they have long been rebelling against the onus of trying to get around the union restrictions on what kind of jobs people can do, then this march of technology is likely to be really quite revolutionary. And it's a reason to be rather optimistic about the profitability of related companies that can benefit from this kind of technology. So this, I think, is again another reason to focus quite as much on the beneficiaries of technology as it is to focus on the producers of new technology. And it has been the clear benefit of autonomy type companies that they've been able to benefit from the production of new kinds of ways of doing things and new methods and new technologies that they've been able to implement into their own businesses so that they can grow their margins. It's been the hallmark of companies that survive over the long term and can continue to raise dividends once they introduce them. What I found particularly interesting in here today was that the solar ETF was in positive territory. And that was against a background where Joe Biden was basically saying yesterday that he does not support the Green New Deal. Now, obviously, his party does. And the bigger picture here is that it's not just about politics. The technology has improved enough so that in certain locations, it's a no-brainer to install solar or wind. So what we are likely to see now is greater competition. It doesn't necessarily mean that solar or wind is right for every location, but it does suggest that where it is right, then we're going to see a great deal more installation. And because we have extraordinarily low interest rates, then it changes the business model for a large number of companies. And Sunrun is a good example of that, because it is a company that allows no upfront investment from consumers. So they get to reduce their utility bills simply by agreeing to have solar panels on their roof. Well, Sunrun is not going to make any money doing that for years. It probably takes about 4 or 5 years before they can recoup their investment. But when you've got interest rates that are close to zero, then they will do that all day long. There is no inhibition in the kind of scale that they can achieve, only in terms of the number of roofs that they can put a new solar panel on. So that then is creating competition for the utilities sector. So utilities themselves are now also engaged in trying to invest in renewable activities because they need to reduce their cost of production. And the primary way they can do that is to streamline the power surges that they have, or demand surges that they have. So the utility sector is, in many respects, rather susceptible to disruption from new technologies and new business models. These are, I think, some of the more important trends that we have out there. The pace of technological innovation continues to accelerate, and it's doing so completely independently of the political environment, but it's not independent of the interest rate environment. The willingness to continue to invest in speculative activity is clearly dependent on interest rates staying low for a prolonged period of time. Well, volatility in the bond markets has been really very low for a long time. And when we think about the MOVE index, it's close to all-time lows. And just like when we look at the VIX index, it is, generally speaking, peaks are more representative of troughs in the bond markets than troughs in volatility are of peaks in the bond market. But when we start to think about what the sources of potential volatility could be, well, it's not all that difficult to think that the willingness of the US government to continue to run extraordinarily large deficits has got to be factored into the outlook for the sustainability of the debt environment. The dollar index was pretty much unchanged in here today. So there is at least some reticence among some European countries as to whether they are going to continue to roll out the fiscal support package that was agreed months ago. That's helping to support the euro, and the euro has rebounded from the 116 level. This hasn't looked like anything other than a consolidation below the 120 area for most of the last couple of months. It was certainly overbought in the short term. We've seen some consolidation. Now I think there is the potential that we're going to see a run back towards the 120 area. The majority of stock markets in Europe today were pretty quiet. The Euro Stoxx index was down a point and still pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. If we just simply look at the World Equities Index page, then it's a pretty similar story right across the region. We did have fireworks, however, in Europe, in Asia. The Nikkei was down 1.5%, so it is pausing again around the 24,000 level. That's been an area of resistance now for most of the last 2.5 years. It's going to have to sustain a move above that area in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The yen, I think, remains one of the most interesting currencies in the world right now because there has been a clear succession of lower rally highs. And every time it has rebounded, then the rebound has been, every time the dollar has rebounded, it has been less impressive. But the Japanese don't want a strong currency. So we're getting increasingly close to the point where they are going to have to decide, are they going to really step in and make the currency weaker again? When we look at the Swiss, and I'm going to have to put this on a line chart because it's not updated particularly well. We can see clearly that the Swiss franc has been defended around the 150 area for most of the last decade. Every time it's got up to this area on a trade-weighted basis, the SNB has stepped in and pushed down the Swiss franc. I think both Switzerland and Japan are doing the same thing. They're using money that the central bank is printing to buy equities. In Japan's case, they're buying domestic equities. In Switzerland's case, they're buying international equities. Well, the international equities gambit is probably a better one because it diversifies the portfolio. It also opens up the potential for higher the cash flows over time, and of course that is also one of the factors that is helping to support the value of the currency. When we then think about what's going on in Australia, well, the ASX 200 was down in a pretty dynamic manner in here today, and it's encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean. Now, I think it's important to highlight that we have got one group of trends in Wall Street that have mostly been able to sustain moves back above their respective trend means and are in the region of their all-time peaks. And then we have trends just about everywhere else where we had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Then we had the big rebound between March and about June. And since then, most markets haven't gone anywhere. What it suggests is that there's been a step down in economic activity, and we're going to have to get through the coronavirus before we can see real recovery taking hold. Obviously, the willingness of governments to continue to support fiscal stimulus is going to be the deciding factor in asset price appreciation. Right now, governments seem to be a little reticent to step on the gas in terms of fiscal stimulus. I do, however, think that it is only a question of when rather than if they are in fact going to go ahead with that, for the very simple reason that because we've had that big step lower in economic potential, then it's simply going to require a lot more stimulus to get us back into a position where we can start finding jobs again for the millions of people who are unemployed. And I think that's going to be one of the big challenges, because when we look back over the repercussions of the coronavirus, it has been a clear accelerant. The continued uptrend, for example, in semiconductors is, I think, emblematic of the fact that when we think about why this rebound has been so powerful, well, it's simple enough. It's accelerated the migration onto digital platforms. And that's something that's, I think, going to be a trend that is going to be exacerbated for the simple reason that in order to get people back to work, then a lot of the jobs that they were doing just don't exist anymore. The rest of those jobs are really rather low paid. And those low-end service jobs, well, those kinds of work, they tend to be done by less well-educated people. So one thing that we've definitely seen over the course of the last 20 years is the hollowing out of the middle class and the ability of less well-educated people to achieve a middle-class lifestyle is being assailed everywhere. Anywhere that less skilled work can be outsourced to either automation or outsourced to overseas workers, it's already been done. Now, the march of the digital technologies is at the, I guess it is dematerializing the economy. There just isn't the same need for physical infrastructure and people to do menial tasks. And that does raise the big question about how much of a rebound are we going to get? And how willing are people going to be to return to doing menial tasks? And this is going to be a very big question for 2021 and onwards. And it pretty much ensures that there is going to be a great deal of stimulative action and that governments are going to be forced, regardless of their reservations, to engage in significant reflationary activity. Well, one of the clearest ways to do that is with infrastructure development. So, copper prices continue to hold around this $3 area. Then, when we think about what Xi Jinping had to say just a couple of days ago, saying that China was going to be carbon neutral by 2040. That's an incredible claim for a country that is building more coal-fired power stations than anybody. So it could, of course, also be another set of projects that are virtue signaling, so they may or may not occur. But in the event that they do occur, it would be a way of stimulating China's infrastructure-led growth model again and rebuilding the entire energy infrastructure around renewables would be incredibly expensive, but also highly stimulative in the short to medium term. Whether it can eventually pay for itself is obviously an open question, but perhaps not one that would be explored in the short or even the medium term. So we are at an interesting point here because it's very likely there will be reflationary efforts. It's really only a question of when we in fact get them. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.